Welcome back to the Greg Kelly Podcast. Thank you for liking, subscribing, all that stuff. It helps a lot. Small development in the past week or so. Am I talking about the Bible too much? I hope not. I hope you don't mind. I think it's the most important thing. And yes, I do. So I make no apologies. And here's the small adjustment that I've made. I was reading it first thing in the morning. Which is great. However, yes, I wake up and I feel the pull of the phone, emails, text messages, what the hell happened on Twitter, that kind of thing. And you find your mind just not as focused as it should be or could be. So what did I do? I am now reading it on the way to work. Now, I've done this before, and now I've tried a lot of different ways, and I think that's the best way. If we have a job, we have to go to work. Actually, I know people are working at home, so this isn't for everybody necessarily, and if you're working at home, there are other ways to do this, but for now, I'm going to pretend you have some sort of a commute, whether it's in the car, whether it's in the on a train or whatever. I happen to take the train. And it gives me the perfect opportunity to read the Bible. And for me, it makes it more central to the day, more relevant. It's not something I did in the morning early, and then my day really starts with the emails and the stuff. That's actually working quite well. And it's something to think about, all right? Because once you get that conversation going with the creator of the universe, well, there. How can you lose? How can you lose? Folks, today we talk to Governor Jim McGreevy, former Governor Jim McGreevy of New Jersey. Now, I first noticed Jim McGreevy in 1997, so I was in the Marine Corps. I was following politics quite a bit, though, back then, and I noticed the Christine Todd Whitman barely held on to her governorship when she was challenged by Governor McGreevy. Or I'm sorry, Jim, who was just a mayor of Woodbridge, New Jersey, moderately sized city in New Jersey, and he came within like 6 votes or something of beating her. That was quite an achievement. And then he was the man to watch. It was just a matter of time. I think he was still in his 30s, by the way. Just a matter of time before Governor McGreevy would be Senator McGreevy, Governor McGreevy, Jim McGreevy. You know what I mean. Michael Corleone could have been Governor Corleone, Senator Corleone. So he had to leave office, though, suddenly. Famous speech, shocked a lot of people. He happened to be gay. He may have made a couple of bad decisions regarding the job and who he hired. But he had to resign. And that shocked a lot of people. It was shocking for where we were as a country that... you know, somebody who was a governor could be gay and could be married and with children. Actually, it was not the married with children part that it was so shocking, but that we had up until that point, a closeted man holding high public office. And then we suddenly found out, well, we've come a long way, haven't we? That is no longer shocking news. As a matter of fact, one's sexual orientation can... make your political name. Pete Buttigieg, former mayor of South Bend, ran a pretty effective campaign for president based, I believe, around the fact that he's gay. He would not have made the impression with the political press corps had he not been. And so interesting that what was a fatal liability in 2004, 2005, is now a breakout attribute. Interesting. We talk a little bit about that, and I happen to like him a lot. He's doing very important work with people in prison and people recently released from prison. Talk about having a challenge. And I know victims of crime have a big challenge too, and we never forget them. But we have this, we have a criminal justice system, and imagine getting out of jail and trying to start your life over again. Hey, one thing that he mentioned to me, which I was pretty impressed by and surprised by, You know who has the lowest recidivism rate among ex-cons? Recidivism being, you know, going back into committing another crime and going back into jail. Murderers. It's like a 1% recidivism rate, you know? You kill once and you do 15 to 25 years, 40 years. Maybe you should do life. Maybe you should be put to death. But there are murderers getting out of jail, and very unlikely that they will kill again. According to what he said, and actually, it was just surprising to me. And look, if I had a business, and I have a small business, and I have, you know, I don't know if I would be inclined to hire somebody who killed somebody, or somebody who assaulted somebody, or somebody who stole something. You know, you'd have to convince me it was worth the risk. Those are some of the things that he deals with in this this nonprofit that he's running, and it's a very significant one, and we'll learn all about it. In the meantime, though, very quickly, I would like to tell you about something that gets me annoyed, and that is being ripped off, and the world is opening up again. I told you I thought I'd get my passport renewed, so I went online to research passport renewal services. The prices are like $150, $200, $280, not including passport photos or the government fee. So, after some snooping around, I realized that all of these ads that I was seeing were from the same company. Fake news. I'm going to have to call the State Department. I got a call in, and that process is ongoing. When I finally get the answers to my questions, I'll tell you about it. Some of these companies, they're charging so much because they have to pay Google. So when you Google passport renewal, their company comes up first, second, or right up there in the list. So a lot of that money they want us to pay, they need because they've got to pay Google for, you know, getting it so high up there on the search. So I'm going to tell you about something called It's Easy. A friend told me about It's Easy, and they have exceptional 5-star passport renewal service that is under $35. $35. I downloaded the It's Easy app. And guess what? It was totally easy. You just fill out the application, take your complimentary passport photo with your own phone. Yes, with your own phone, you take the passport photo. You don't have to go to the pharmacy or anything like that. The app allows you to take your passport photo with your own phone. That is game-changing stuff. You print out the application that It's Easy immediately emails you with a trackable shipping label that's also included. All you have to do is print it out and send it in with your most recent passport, and that's it. It is so easy and so affordable, under $35, not the hundreds of dollars other companies are trying to milk from us. I realized It's Easy has been in business for 40 years, so you're getting 40 years of value. It is a 5-star company that you can trust 100% with your documents. So, if you have to get a passport, I'm telling you, there is no other way. It's easy. Download the app from the Apple or Android App Store today. Do yourself a favor. Don't be fooled. When you need a passport renewed, think It's Easy. Just spell it out. It's easy. ItsEasy. It's easy. See you on the road somewhere. Summer's almost here. Now, by the way, you grew up in the church, and you wrote about this in your book. You were very...
But I'm back with the RCs, though.
You're not what?
I'm back with the RCs.
With the Rome? You're back with the Roman Catholics?
Yeah.
I mean, you're back with them. You go to church. Yes.
I go to Mass a little bit.
Well, so do I, and I'm glad to hear that. First of all, I read the book about a year and a half ago, which is a fantastic book, and you're incredibly honest and open, and it was
just... We should talk about this on the radio.
Oh, no. Well, actually, if you don't mind, we can talk about it on the radio, or we can talk about it on my podcast right now.
Yeah, want to do it right now?
Yes, please.
Are we on?
Yes. Now, look, let me tell you something. I will... anything you don't like, let me know.
No, I'm good with anything. I'm past all of it.
and that's one of the things that I really loved about your book. You know, when your life is exposed, you have nothing to hide. And I don't know. I thought it was great. But you talked a lot about your faith as a young man. And here's what I liked about it. And then I'll stop talking for a moment. You were the only political figure, the only famous person, quite frankly, who spoke about their faith as a child as a positive thing. And I was wondering, okay, when is this going to end badly? And it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Right.
But I think a lot of people have had really positive views of their faith.
They do.
I think the majority actually do, Greg.
I mean, the
guys and gals I know, definitely. I mean, they may not talk about it because I don't know how popular it is to talk about. But it's like, you know, you see it when how they raise their children. You see it in how they, you know, whether it's Passover or Easter or, you know, and the holidays and their faith. And like most of, like overwhelmingly, they may say, look, I'm not a good Jew or I'm a bad Catholic or I'm not a great Christian or, you know, or Muslim. But at the same time, those core values are with them.
Yes.
And they value them.
They do. I guess, but no, I'm not saying that that's not true. I believe that is true, what you just said.
Yeah.
But reading your book, like when these things make it into the movies and or books, they're usually presented negatively. In pop culture, faith is almost always seen as, you know, a joke or, you know, corrupt, or there's just something wrong with it. And I guess when I was reading your book, I was waiting for that to happen and it didn't. And I was like, I thought it was really cool, quite frankly, that you just, yeah, there was no downside to it. There was just this remarkable upside.
Yeah. And it just, and to me, it's like faith is so much a part of who and what I am and the world. I mean, there was that great line by Rabbi Sacks, you know, science tells us how the world works. Faith tells us why it works. And so, you know, why do we get up in the morning? Why do we sacrifice? Why do we try to make it work for our family? Why do we build community? And so it's you know, the work that I do every day with people coming out of prison or county jails or addiction treatment centers, they're yearning for the why. I mean, the how is important for me in terms of science and the world and the, you know, the mysteries of the world. But in terms of the why, I don't know if you've ever seen the TED Talk with Simon Sinek, and he talks about, you know, the core secrets to marketing. It's not what, it's not how, it's why. It's why Dr. King talked about, you know, gave his speech. It's why Apple computers are attractive. It's the why is so critically important. And for me, you know, however you understand faith, it's the why sort of gives us meaning and gives us depth in terms of our own personal narratives. And that's what I think is so, so rich. So when you look at Carl Jung or you look at Joseph Campbell or you look at narratives throughout history or the spiritual or the religious narratives, it's that why. And I, you know, it's, I don't think, you know, what I get frustrated with sometimes in the media, it almost becomes faith, almost becomes a caricature of itself, which I think is unfortunate both from everybody's perspective, because it motivates people to do so much good, so much selfless giving, and it's not about one political stripe. People may construe it that way, but I mean, there are just as many people on the left or the right, whether they have whatever faith or whatever tradition, that motivates them to be in community, to be giving, to be concerned.
Now, you are working with folks just getting out of prison. You've done a lot of work inside prisons, and I don't want to get into the specifics of that, but there are folks in jail who come out believers. They enter prison. What do they call them? They call it a jailhouse conversion.
Jailhouse conversion, exactly. That's the term.
Now, is that a genuine conversion? Is it a? Is it? How would you characterize it? Sometimes when I heard that, though, I got to tell you, when I heard the term, I didn't really like it because it kind of. Okay, it made it sound like kind of pat and like, okay, yeah, well, what else are you going to do in jail? I don't know. There was something about it that made me disappointed.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I have friends of mine who said that, you know, they were in state prison and the only places that were air conditioned was the church, was the shul, was the mosque, and they went to every religious service. But so, I mean, yeah, no, there are people that are doing it to frankly get out of their cell. There are people who are doing it because they're either angry, lonely, tired, and there are people. But I think it's all good. I think anytime you expose someone to the great issues of faith or to the questions of why. And for me, you know, Greg, at this point in my life, I mean, you know, and I had the benefit of 3 years of seminary, but, you know, it's not the question of how many angels exist on the head of a pin. It's why we do things. It's the lessons of Jesus. It's the purposes of the parables. And so, you know, I'm not questioning the great, you know, why there's evil in the world or how did the world start. I mean, I appreciate the metaphor of Genesis, but it's just like how I live my life. And so my Christianity, my Catholicism informs my values and informs my behavior. And whether, you know, and I have close friends that are Muslim and Jewish or don't believe or Hindu, but it's you know, somebody once, an old pastor told me in prison, he said, you know, Jim, we all have a God. And a God for him was, as they say in the rooms in AA or NA, it's a general ordering direction, G-O-D. And he said, whether that God is alcoholism or whether that God is money or chaos or violence or the streets or ego or sex, you know, for him, those were false gods. But his point is, there's something about which, and, you know, Marcus Aurelius refers to it, the thing that we hold in our mind every day, the thing that we focus on more than often. I mean, God willing, I've taught my daughters to, you know, to do morning prayer and to think about, you know, our vertical relationship with our higher power. But I mean, whatever it is, I mean, when I was in politics, it's about getting reelected. It's about money. It's about the political process. That was my God. And I have a very different God now. So it's not about me proving, you know, getting into a metaphysical debate with a philosophy or a theologian. It's how it informs my life, how it shapes my values, my behavior, my actions. And that's what counts. And I'll leave everything out to G-D.
So, obey God and believe in Him. Tell the truth and oh gosh, I'm
yeah.
Not...
And then you know as you know it's in Leviticus, but you know for me Jesus and you know said you know do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know there are two commandments and you know get it together. So hopefully you know. And you get to a point in life that you realize, you know, this doesn't go on forever. I mean, I'm 63 and then, you know, I see, you know, friends who have died and friends who are grappling with whether it's cancer or different challenges. And you realize the mortality of life. So at the end, the clock runs out no matter how healthy or how many walks we go on or how much quinoa we eat. I mean, so at the end of the day, it's, you know, all right, how have I made a difference? What have I given back? How have I reshaped community? How have I bettered my country? How have I bettered my world? And so I think faith helps inform that.
So, by the way, you've got this great way. You're highly educated, but you do it in a way that is genuine and also so... You know, there's almost a working class way when you invoke the Bible, Leviticus, or when you're talking about Joseph Campbell, you can quote, or Marcus Aurelius, you quote great literature in the Bible in a way that is so real yet not pretentious. Even people who are not being pretentious who quote it, it can put people on the defensive, but it's so natural when you do it. Have you ever heard that before? Do people remarked upon how and your examples are so applicable. They're not pie in the sky. I noticed you actually wrote that way as well. Do you know what am I talking about? Am I crazy?
Yeah,
here?
But I just, you know, Greg, for me, it's you know, working, you know, Irish family. My grandfather's a police officer in Jersey City. My dad was DI. My mom was a nurse. I mean, whereas as, you know, we were working class. I mean, God bless my parents, who 63 years of marriage after they moved out of Jersey City, same house, same, you know, same plot of grass, same, you know, above ground pool.
You know, Governor, no, I know where you come from, and I know those things. But the thing about it is, for a while in politics, and there was this, you were supposed to be better than other people. You were supposed to be kind of, you have an elite cachet that was good in politics. Yeah. And then I think now it's totally, that's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
The people are not looking for that. I think, quite frankly, you had that way about you that was, you've adjusted with the time. I'm not saying you consciously did this, but you're very reflective of the times we're living in a good way.
No, thanks, Greg. But I'll tell you though, like nobody in South Amboy or Woodbridge gave a darn where I went to school. At the end of the day, it's like, all right, are you going to be able to get me my license? Are you going to be able to help me get my mother into a nursing home so that I don't bankrupt the family? Do my children, you know, in public school or in Catholic school, are they going to be able to access the internet? And can you make our community stronger and feel good about what it is to be an American from New Jersey? So, I mean, you can have all the education in the world, but if you're not building community, who gives a darn? And candidly, there were a lot of people that had great educations, excuse me, that were worth shit in terms of improving the quality of life. I mean, at the end, I remember going down to the state legislature, and there was, God rest his soul, he passed on, John Adler. So I used to look at John, and John, you know, went to Harvard College and went to Harvard Law School. And I'm like, John read every bloody bill that has ever crossed his desk. And so I was just a little, I mean, the only thing I, because I had to go back home, there was a bill on the desecration of the flag. And I went, like, you know, I actually, like, sponsored that there'd be penalties. I said, look, you know, I got to go home for Easter and Christmas. And John says, oh, my gosh. But I remember that I figured he'd read every bill. He was common sense. He was a rational guy. So I'm going to vote just the way he did. And in the meantime, I'm going to make sure that in front of Mrs. Kelly's house or Mr. Schwartz's backyard, that you know, whether the pothole was fixed or the line that was electrical line was down, I would call up the utility and get that done. Because at the end of the day, it's the pragmatic impact on people's lives that make you a great mayor, and that, you know, that transform lives. So it's not about the speeches. It's not about all the yap, yap, yap. It's what you do. It's like, you know, to a degree, it's Tammany Hall. It's that chicken in every pot. And, you know, and for people, particularly for the working poor and the poor, it's working with houses of worship. It's being able to give people hope to hang on so that life is going to be a little better, not only for themselves, but for their children.
I love all that. And that makes total sense. And
yeah,
that makes you,
it's just like, you know, it's just like, you know, with the Republican or Democratic Party. I mean, both parties go off the rails, and like with the yap, yap, yap. I mean, how is it changing people's lives for the better? How is it building community? How is it making us, you know, proud? How is it improving the quality of schools for our children? And particularly in a global economy. I mean, we've got to produce.
The only folks who do care about that stuff that I was talking about, where you went to school, how you sound, the media. And actually, Elliot Spitzer told me that. He's like, nobody ever asked me where I went to college or law school except for people in the media. They're the only ones who are fixated on it. And I don't think even the media aren't fixated. No one's really fixated on anything. I mean, there was a time where, you know, a reporter could really think only about Jim McGreevy for days on end.
Yeah.
Like in the 90s. I mean, now they're just, no one is breaking out. I don't know. I'm a little bit all over the place. Let me ask you this.
No. But I mean, I don't want to leave that. I think your point's well taken, because there's so much news. There's so much out there. It becomes hard for people to focus. But I would argue, to go to your point, that's all the more reason why we should be talking about things that matter to people's lives. Because if at the end of the day, when you're getting, you know, whether it's policy papers or politics or opinions or issues of the day, what counts to you are those things that materially alter your life. And I think that that still resonates with voters and people.
Most definitely. So look, was the highlight of your, one of the highlights of your life, I would imagine, was it 97 when you almost beat Governor Whitman? I did not know you. I had no plan. I don't even know where I was. But when I heard that, I just thought, wow, that guy's got to be on top of the world. That guy's going to be president. So you almost beat Governor Whitman. You were the mayor of Woodbridge, I believe, at the time, right?
Yeah.
And you were, so no one, just the office sounds so small.
It was so classic, Greg, if I can. I remember the first, so I went to a buddy of mine who was a state senator, another friend of mine is attorney, and I'm never, you know, he asked me, do you want to run? And I'm like, you know, forget it. I mean, Governor Whitman, she's the manor born. Her family's been here since the Mayflower. My grandfather got off the boat from Ireland. I mean, what are you, crazy? And he said, well, what chance do you have against Governor Whitman? And I said, honestly, I said probably, I think I said 12, 15%. He said, what chance do you have if you don't run? I said, zero. And he says, well, you know, 15% or 12% is better than zero. But I'll give you one anecdote. So the one anecdote is the first fundraiser I had was at the Island VFW. And we brought in, it was under $15,000. I forget what it was. The same, and the next day they had a beautiful picture of the governor, Governor Whitman, and she looked stunning in this sequence dress, and she raised like $1.4 million. I remember the Star Ledger, and she looked good, and John Whitman, her late husband, who was a big fan of, who served the nation. And I'm like looking at myself like, you know, here they are, you know, good people, I mean, just, you know, raising a ton of, I'm like, where am I going with this campaign? I mean, like, I'm at the Island VFW. We're like, you know, I don't even know if they served the sliders that night. I knew, you know, but the funny thing was, is ultimately at the end of the day, to go back to how we started the conversation, is I talked about property taxes. I talked about auto insurance rates at the time. And I talked about, you know, kids being able to, young people, children being able to read, because if you don't read at age appropriate levels at three, you know, by the time you're four and you're five and you're reading for science and reading for math and reading for history and reading for reading, you start falling further and further behind. But so anyway, all I did was talk about property taxes. All I did was talk about auto insurance and early childhood literacy. And a buddy of mine, Mike Aaron, who ran New Jersey Network, would say, if he asked McGreevy how the weather was, he'd give you his 3-point mantra. So, I mean, eventually we broke through, but it was a great night. It was a great night.
Did everything
to run that hard and to start that far behind. It's not always in life where you end up, but how far you travel.
Did you think to yourself, like, I don't know, like, not only did it, what did the future look like? Did you say, okay, I'm definitely running in 4 years, or screw that, I'm going to run for the Senate? What were your immediate plans?
Yeah, I was never a Washington guy. I mean, maybe I was when I was a young man. I thought about going to Washington, you know, the dome and all that represented him in terms of the Kennedys and whatever. But I think, though, being mayor changed that, like the action was in the executive branch, whether it was mayor. And so for me, it was just, we came so close. And I felt good about it, though, because we didn't have the money. We didn't have the prestige and we didn't have the endorsements. It was just, I mean, the truth be told, you know, we were up to 11:37 at night. I remember this. And then, you know, the votes came in from what I call horse country, Somerset County, and the governor put it over the top, Governor Whitman. And she was always somebody that I liked and respected. And I had worked previously for Governor Kane. I was the director of the state parole board. And so New Jersey had a great history of bipartisan. I mean, here's this scrappy kid from you know, Jersey City and Woodbridge, and only Tom Kane would have, you know, made me the executive director of the state parole board. And I was interested in Holocaust education. He put me on the commission. I mean, I don't know if that would ever happen now, but Tom Kane was a pretty special human being, as he still is. And so, I think by that point, Greg, I knew it was the executive branch. And so I kept my eyes focused on governor. And except for the one interruption with my dear friend, Bob Torricelli, who, you know, the Democrats became in the minority in the Senate, and Bob all of a sudden decided, he had, a different brand of oatmeal, and he wanted to get in the governor's race just for, a couple of weeks. Other than that, I stayed focused on the governor's race.
Doesn't it seem now, actually... Obvious, when you had your moment and that remarkable press conference and you talked about your personal life, looking back, you realize that America, that we're the one, the country should be embarrassed, not you. Like, the fact that that was shocking information talks about where the country was, not you. I mean... I think it says more about...
Yeah, but just like, to be fair to America and to be fair, Greg, to the world, I mean, I may be old-fashioned, but I think this is the greatest country in the world. And a kid from Jersey City two generations ago, his grandfather came off the boat, his grandparents came off the boat. And we always grapple with challenges in this country in terms of freedoms and how we understand ourselves and, the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. I mean, they weren't perfect documents, but we try to keep doing better. And sometimes it's messy and sometimes it's uncomfortable and, whatever. But, more than any place in the world, we get it right. And so, gay rights was something like... was something foreign to most people. And in terms of, you look at the history in Great Britain, I think, which was in so many ways, the UK, sort of modeled our sense of what it meant to be free and who. But I mean, like, they were putting people in prison for being gay in terms of the 1850s and the 19th century. So I think, to the credit of the nation. I mean, we caught up and it's remarkable how far it's come. That to me, that just knocks me out. I mean, just in terms of, you go to a college campus and, for me, it would have been, I never would have shown up at a meeting because I didn't want to be identified as being gay. You go to a campus now and they're talking about infrastructure, Biden, like nobody's talking about anything about sexuality. I mean, maybe they did after I left, but it's amazing how quote unquote normal it is today, or regular, for lack of a better word.
And look, so that's why I want to ask you about Pete Buttigieg. It's kind of wild where we are, how fast we've come. Here, I mean, it's conceivable that if you were born a little bit later, you could have run not for governor of New Jersey, but for president of the United States as an out gay mayor of a place like Woodbridge. I mean, it's kind of astonishing. And by the way, Buttigieg being gay is the thing that, quite frankly, made him so appealing to the national press and to a lot of other people. I mean, that's what made him different, special, and that he wouldn't have won Iowa if he did win Iowa. I don't know what the hell happened there, but you know what I mean. This guy became a superstar because of his orientation, in part.
Yeah, and I think it's also, Greg, I mean, it's also why the business community, it's interesting, because the business community wants people that are, wants people that are on their individual merits to succeed. And the irony is on so much in terms of LGBT rights, I mean, that businesses were like, this doesn't make sense. And so it's just interesting to see the increasing role that the business community, I think, constructively can play in this country. And they are increasingly. But with Pete, it was just his personal story, his honesty, his charisma, and a certain amount of it's just guts, that whoever you are, that you have the guts to be who you are. And I guess the, you know, the new word in politics is authenticity. And, you know, whether it's, you know, the new, you know, whether it's persons, whether it's Pete Buttigieg or Reverend as a new senator in Georgia, it's people talking about their stories. I mean, Pete Buttigieg talked about his faith. He talked about the role of faith. He talked about, you know, how it was motivated. So I think it's interesting. I think people want to see people that are real, that are actual, that are, you know,
yeah,
that make a difference and put themselves out there. None of us are perfect. All of us are flawed. But to the extent that we can show honestly and openly, authentically who we are, I think God bless us.
Just one thing about being a straight male, a white male, a Christian male. I know I am not alone.
Well, you got all the strikes against you.
Yeah, well, suddenly it feels that way, actually.
No, don't worry.
No, I mean, look, I've heard folks say, oh, come on, white people have had it just fine for a long time. But suddenly, I must say, I do feel like that is somehow just not considered fashionable. And I'd rather it not be fashionable nor unfashionable. I'm just surprised it's a thing. And so much of our life, our culture, is just celebrating the stuff that you were born as, whether it was gay, bisexual, lesbian, transgender. And I don't know if that is important. I don't know if that, I know I, in my book, it's not important. In my book, it's...
Yeah, but I will say this, Greg. I hear what you're saying. But let me just push back a little bit. So when I here Jim McGreevy was governor, and by all appearances is obviously straight, and then you come out as being gay, and it's just and no disrespect. I mean, I think people can understand. Because, you know, somebody like Greg Kelly, smart, capable, can understand it, but on an emotional level. And then all of a sudden, you know, because I say who, you know, and I don't want to be trite and so say, you know, this is my truth, but all of a sudden then, you know, at that time, I couldn't marry. If I was in a relationship, I couldn't go to the hospital. I wouldn't have death benefits. And all of a sudden, I just, and you know what, and I'm not like, you know, and, you know, my if you ask my younger daughter, you know, I'm pretty, you know, I think, you know, I'm sort of old fashioned in certain ways in terms of my respect and strength of this country. But what strikes me is in the space that I'm in now on gay rights, I was like blown away, like one bloody speech later, and this is what happens. Holy shit. And you realize this in real ways, and not that any of my friends, all my buddies stayed, my friends and all my friends that were, you know, everybody stayed, but your legal rights profoundly change. And then, so for me is, it's just like, you know, and I'm not, you know, I don't know, some of my conservative buddies would say I'm to the left of Trotsky, but actually I think I'm pretty grounded. But, you know, what gets me is like, you know, and I see this every day. So when I work with kids from a certain county, the majority community, and some kid has a heroin addiction and he gets screwed up and he's with fentanyl and what happens. And I can get that kid into a good treatment program because their parents, God bless them, have good insurance. And some kid who's from like an urban area who has a single mother who's on Medicaid gets like 5 days of treatment for a heroin addiction. And it doesn't take, because it never effing will. And the kid goes out and gets another bag of dope and gets arrested. That kid's in jail. And it's just like, you know, and I'm like, and by the way, I'm a former assistant prosecutor, and my grandfather's a cop, and my cousins are cops. But I am telling you that, Greg, from my heart, you know, and some of it clearly is race in different parts of this country, or even in this part of the country, but it's also economics, that the resources on education, the resources of healthcare, the resources for insurance, the resources for healthcare, the resources to get a license the resources to get a driving school isn't helps determine where you wind up in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what drives me nuts. Like, really? Like, you're going to have a kid, and I see this every day. I mean, like, look, I go nuts when a kid has to cut off his dreads to get a job in a hotel, but I mean, whatever, because who you are. But on the addiction piece, Greg, I see this. Like, I mean, swear to good Lord, every single day, that, like, poor African-Americans, Latino or white kids, but, like, overwhelmingly African-American, Latino kids, they'll get treatment because the Medicaid will give them treatment for 5 days for heroin addiction. Like, are you for real? A heroin addiction for 3 months, let alone 3 years, is going to be cured in 5 days? Get the blank out of here. And then because mom and dad has, God bless them, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and has or ABC policy, that kid will get 3 months or maybe 6 months. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't know.
Oh, no. So you're taking this back to, so parents who are married.
I see that identity. Yeah, I see that as, like, you know, I guess I see the reverse all the time, in the sense that young people, and I deal mostly with, you know, I'd say about, Greg, about 80% of our clients are men, 20% are women. But I see it in terms of, so I'm trying to tell these young guys, look, believe in this country, do the right thing, you know, go to school. And I'm tough on these guys. I mean, like a friend of mine said, one day somebody's going to crack you in the mouth, Jim, because I don't, like, you know, as hard as I fight for them, and I fight with it with every fiber of my being, because I want America to work, but I'm tough on these guys. Like, you know, I pull a Jack McGreevy DI because I don't let them, you know, pull up the effing pants, you know, take the hat off when you walk inside, be respectful, you know, when you see that elderly woman crossing the street, you go over and assist her. It's like old school respect. And so, like, because I want America to work, but I guess my only sense, though, is that at the end of the day, Greg, opportunity has to be for all of us, and that to me is so critically important. And I don't see that. So, like, I mean, we're opening a new training center, and, like, I talked to, like, God bless Francine Lafrac, and Francine's educating our women right now on financial services, like, you know, what's the difference between a interest-bearing account, or, you know, what's the difference between a debit card and a credit card? What's the difference between a checking account and savings account? Hey, Greg Kelly learned all these great things because he had a mom and dad that knew those things, and every generation had built. And I deal with a lot of guys and gals who, frankly, don't start out from the race of life, from the same place, either economically, culturally, and in terms of so many services. So in any event.
No, I think that's... Well,
that's a hell of a long answer.
It's all great stuff. And it stands on its own. You made me think of one thing, though.
Yeah, and just like, but I understand what you're saying, but I just want you to understand that for, you know... It sounds corny, but every day I used to have my daughter say, every day before she went to school, that you're a precious and valuable child of God, right? That you're a precious and valuable child of God. That I'm a strong, powerful, independent, healthy girl. I'm a precious and valuable child of God. And so what happens is, Greg, and I worked with the women for 3.5 years behind the wall. I can tell you, Greg, overwhelmingly, every woman felt like, I'm never going to be a good mother. I'm always going to be a crack addict. I'm never going to hold a job. And you talk about narratives in your head, narratives that Jim McGreevy has, narratives that Greg Kelly has, narratives that, you know, the woman that I had, they're completely different because, and I'm not excusing their bad behavior, although I would say if I were in their shoes, I would have made many of the probably worse decisions. But I mean, the point being is, the stories we tell ourselves are really important. And those stories we learn from almost from infancy. And so a lot of the stories that people learn, you know, there's a whole thing. We had a whole conference the other day and was talking about trauma. And one of the psychiatrists, this guy, Petrus Lavonis, Stanford College, Stanford Medical School. And then there was Craig Haney, who oversaw something called the Stanford Prison Experiment. And they were talking about how you see yourself. Like, if there's a tough corner that Greg Kelly says, I'm going to get out of, but Jim McGreevy, who might have grown up in a tough situation, might be at that corner because actually I feel comfortable in that corner. But then the other problem is that I learned to expect challenges or problems. Kelly may walk across the street, McGreevy may stay in that corner, actually increasing the probability that I got to clean up my language, I'm on a podcast, that I'll get into some shit. And so it's just interesting. So it's you know, not just where we start the race of life, but how these things have impacted us. And I would argue, Greg, impacted our stories, how we understand ourselves and how we understand ourselves and how we understand our place in the world.
Yes, I guess. And I'm glad you said all of those important things. I guess my point is smaller in that. And I recognize fully what you said and what really resonated. Yes, if you were born that person, if I were born into anybody else's position and everything that happened to them happened to me, I'd be the same person. I would.
Yeah.
Dale Carnegie, I think, made that observation once. So look, but the thing about this is you mentioned at some point pride. And that made me think of, you know, the pride parades, which I've covered. My father marched in. To show support, as a lot of community leaders did, and I always thought it was great. But lately, I'm not so sure. And let me just tell you why, and then I want to move on to the criminal justice issues. But for me, it's like you mentioned your daughters are cherished children of God.
Yep.
And I agree. I think we are all cherished children of God. I don't think they're cherished because I don't think I'm cherished because I'm heterosexual. I don't think someone is cherished because they are gay. I don't think that's really what makes them them. And when I see, what I see right now, quite frankly, is an over celebration, an over emphasis on things that I don't see why I would ever take pride in being heterosexual. I don't see why anyone would take pride in being gay because with it.
Like, and I'll push back because nobody ever beat the shit out of you because you were straight.
I understand.
And so, like, I mean, like,
but
I'm
you think
sure,
is that happening now?
Sure. No, and your point's well taken because like 20-year-old kid. But so, I don't know if I'm the right person to respond to that. But I will say this: that I mean, and you know, there was a great article in the New York Times about the dangers of identity politics and democracy. You know, and you know, they talked about Roosevelt saying the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And he talked about us as being Americans, Americans, Americans. And I think that's so important. I mean, so that's the danger of, I mean, I think identity politics can have a benefit maybe culturally, but I think in terms of who we are as Americans, our strength is obviously our commonality in terms of our virtue and our belief in the American experience. And so you know, so there's always the tension between the group because obviously, you know, if I'm whatever race or ethnicity or religion or sexuality or sexual orientation, I mean, that puts me into a certain category. But I need to be able to speak to Greg. I need to be able to speak to women. I need to be able to speak to. I need to cross the boundaries. So. That's why I think Joe Biden, you know, when he had Father Leo and the prayer that he gave, and Joe Biden talks about, you know, our better angels, to paraphrase Lincoln, I think he's trying to re-engender some sense of what it means to be virtuous or to be of service as an American. But I understand what you're I understand what you're saying in terms of that tension. So, I mean, for me, it's trying to have young men feel good about themselves. You know, I always put on the tape when the guys come into the program. We have 11,000 clients, and I put on the tape of Dr. King and the last speech on Memphis, where he says, you know, I may not get with you to the promised land, but, you know, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. But, and he said, you know, but I don't fear any man. I just want to do God's will in my life. So we always try to go back to doing the next right thing, God's will, God's will. And, you know, my point is Dr. King was willing to make that the cornerstone of his life. Let's try to do that in our lives.
Love it. By the way, you mentioned Joe Biden. You were the governor of New Jersey. He's a senator of a neighboring state.
The great state of Delaware.
Great state. Small state of Delaware. Not terribly populous. A lot more people voted for you to be governor than voted for him to be senator. So let me just ask you, though. I assume you cross paths, maybe work together a little bit. What's he like? What's your take?
Anybody has the tea shake in the White House for St. Patrick's Day, and being a Kelly. I just find him to be really authentic. I just find him to be, you know, proud of his Irish roots. Working class Scranton, Delaware. I like the fact that he says that he wants to work with Republicans and Democrats. I don't know if it happens.
Not yet.
Yeah. It's just like, our country's got to get back to people like Everett Dirksen and people that were understood that, God willing, it's the nation that's first. It's the country that's first. It's our children and our grandchildren that, you know, and it's opportunity. But in any event, so no, I think he's a great guy. I mean, anybody who hops on an Amtrak train to go back to put his kids to bed is every night is doing something right in terms of his values.
You were governor, and right across the river, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, superstar. Did you ever meet him? What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, I found him on the human level, when I was governor, to be very, very decent. And I think, you know, being a business person and dealing with Atlantic City and the casinos, I found him because, I mean, what I did was we increased the taxation level on the casinos because we wanted to invest in early childhood pre-kindergarten education. I found him fairly easy to work with. I mean, he wanted to cut a deal, and God rest his soul, my friend Arthur Goldberg and others who happen to be Democrats were not as easy on me. But this is, I knew him as a businessman, not as a political candidate or as a president.
Now, I know you've said before that, you know, look, I think you've said before, no way would you ever run again. But let's just, for a moment, you are, you're out and about, you are smart, you're experienced. Being gay is no longer an obstacle. If anything, it is a significant benefit in today's culture. Why would you not consider, and there's a hell of a lot of turnover, let's face it, in New Jersey politics.
It's Greg, it's, I love what I do. I mean, you know, Al Sharpton said something really powerful yesterday at our conference, and we had Van Jones, who was incredible, and we had Governor Christie and Reverend Al. And Al said something really, to me, really powerful and simple. He says, you know, you do good in the world. Yeah, it has a impact on others, but you do good for yourself. You do reentry, but you do it for yourself. And I mean, he wasn't talking about me particularly, but he was talking to us. So it's like, you know, second chances. I mean, in the Bible, scripture says, you know, our Lord says, don't forgive, you know, seven times, but 70 times seven. And so it's making it work. I mean, like, it's one of the few places, I'll tell you, I mean, Governor Christie's on our board and Governor Kane is on our board and Governor Corzine and Floria. But I mean, it's one of the few places, I think, in America that you look at addiction rates, you look at recidivism rates, and we have to do this better. I mean, whether it's the Koch brothers on the right, or you know, religious leaders or people on the left. I mean, you know, I think people understand that we need to help people, give them the tools, whether it's addiction treatment, whether it's psychological, and employment. If these guys don't get a job and these gals don't get a job, I mean, Craig, what are they going to do? You have to eat three times a meal. You need to put your head down at night. You have to have a job. My father used to say the best social program in the world is a job. We need to give. So we're opening on April 28th a new 9-classroom center. And I, you know, people like Francine Lafrac, I mean, just incredible. I mean, just helping our women with Same Sky, teaching our women, or, you know, our women were making jewelry that they're going to sell, and they're going to school at night at the county college, or they're becoming a cosmetologist. And it's just like, you've got to help people get into the American dream. You can't write people off. And if 95% of the people are coming home out of prison, if we don't help them address their hepatitis, address their diabetes, address their addiction, give them a skill, they're going to go back and do the same shit they've always done. So I say to my, you know, my Republican friends that this is a buttoned-up program, we're tough, you know, it's about employment. And I say to my Democratic friends, it's about second chances. We're trying to redress some of the imbalances, candidly, of failed systems, whether it's healthcare, whether it's schools, whether it's criminal justice, that at the end of the day, make somebody productive. You know, I'll just leave you with this thought, Greg. The prosecutors love me, because the public defenders are like, Jim, all right, he's innocent. I'm like, no, yeah, wait. I am not letting somebody out of prison who has a heroin needle in their arm. That's not my game. I'm about healthy, engaged people that are being productive and that are, you know, or feel that are employed and giving back to their, providing for their family. Like, that person is going to addiction treatment, and that person is going to job training. And they're like, no. And I'm like, 98% of the time I'm with the PDs and the crazy leftos in the legislature. But when I come into courtroom by courtroom, I want to have our gals and guys be, I want them to have the same access, the same privileges, the same benefits as anybody in New Jersey. And for so many of them, they didn't have it growing up because of what zip code they were born into.
Sure. I'm sorry. Give me just 4 more minutes if you can. The New Jersey, sure. The New Jersey Reentry Corporation. That is your nonprofit, correct?
Yeah.
How big is it?
Well, we have over 11,000 clients, and you know, and we have 9 sites, and we bust our asses every day to get people opportunities. And, you know, whether it's medical, whether it's mental health, whether it's addiction, we have legal services, we have biopsychosocial services, housing referrals, and then employment. But before you do employment, the old way of do it is throw somebody in a job and see if they last. Our position is no, training, that you have to be a highly skilled, and whether it's a CDL, whether it's an HVAC, whether it's solar, whether it's a mechanics license, whether it's pre-apprenticeship program to the construction trades, it's having a skill. The idea of just letting somebody out and saying good luck and God bless is nuts.
When you say 11,000 clients, are these ex-prisoners?
Yeah.
Now, and do you have, is there a crime that if they, say, committed a murder? I mean, are we talking about everybody from murderers to shoplifters?
Murder.
Anybody?
I mean, and then the other thing is, Greg, you know, the irony is people say murder, and but the murderers actually have the lowest recidivism rate in the country. It's 1%. And then the guys that I love to work with are guys that, you know, did 30 years of punitive. I mean, guys that are 55 years of age or 60. They've got a 1% chance of recidivism and another 1% because of their age. I mean, the younger guys, when I'm dealing with these guys, like, you know, they're wearing a green or orange jumpsuit and they're telling me, like, how they have everything right. And I'm like, well, why in God's name are we here in jail? But in any event, I love dealing with the older guys. You know, they have wisdom. A lot of them, frankly, had shitty breaks. You know, I won't get into my rant on the criminal justice system, but they actually want to do something. They want to give back. They want the young guys not to make mistakes they did. And they're sincere about it. We've got a great group, 30 over 30. These are 30 guys who have spent 30 years behind the wall.
Yeah.
These are some of the most wonderfully aware, good, loving, thoughtful men I know in my life. And, you know, it's just like, you know, they want to really do something different. They want to give back. They want to make sure the next generation of young men, particularly in women, communities of color, don't make the choices they made. They want to tell them, look, prison is not where you belong. Prison isn't a rite of passage. You belong in school. You belong in a training program. You belong in a healthy relationship with that person in your life. You've got to take care of your kids, and let's break this cycle.
Love it. By the way, njreentry.org, njreentry.org. We'll put it in the show notes. Fantastic website. I got two very quick things. Have you ever seen,
sure.
Did you ever see when you were a kid, there was a show called, a special called Scared Straight? It was a documentary.
Yes. Yeah. Those guys are my buddies.
You Rahway Prison. They brought up. They'd bring kids in there, and they would basically let the felons, I mean, these hardcore criminals, scare them straight. I don't know if it worked. It was so amazing.
I know. I'm actually, like, I used to be mayor of Woodbridge, and actually the Rahway State Prison is actually in Woodbridge. It was called Rahway because it had a Rahway zip code, Rahway lockbox. But those guys, a lot of those guys, like, I would go to church or to Christmas Mass, and I would always joke with the guys and you know, say, like, you know, it's good to be among the Democrats because all the Republicans are in federal prison. But I mean, like, I love those guys, and we're trying to do something now called rehabilitative release, so that if you've been behind the wall for 30, 35 years, and it's, you know, you participated in a murder maybe when you were 17, 18 years old, because that's what you did, trying to get these guys an opportunity to get out so that they spend the last 20 years of their life, you know, in New Jersey, with New Jersey Reentry and outside of the wall. But yeah, I mean, Greg, it's just, you know, I would just say this, that when people drive past those concrete walls, I mean, they don't think that, and you know, the barbed wire, that everybody behind there is a monster. There are as many good guys and bad guys as they are anywhere. And a lot of folks made a bad decision based on the resources they had, based on the thinking they had, and based on the options they had before them. And that's not by way of an excuse, but maybe by way of explanation. And I'll leave you with this one thought. This young woman who I love, and I worked with her for 3.5 years. She grew up in Camden Public Housing. Her father was African American, her mother was Italian, and I tell you that because, I mean, she was not accepted by any community. Her mother was a crack prostitute, and she would send her daughter out to sell drugs literally like every day. By the time she was 13 years old, she was sexually assaulted 5 times. And she said to me, because I would always be concerned that she would never cry, she said the 6th time she came in the bathtub and she washed herself. And she said, Jimmy, that's the last time I cried. Life was just that brutal. It was just that shitty. And so what happened is eventually her mother lost her house and she joined a gang. She became the partner of the gang member, of the lead of the gang to survive. And the gang did some really bad stuff. I mean, she was never at the scene of a crime, but she was part of the gang. And anyway, long story short, I mean, she's facing 20 plus years, and I break every barrier. I talk to everybody, and a good buddy I won't mention, who was then first assistant attorney general, he's like, Jim, like, you're out of control. She was just a great young woman, had no chance, right? And she said to me, and I got to know her, that the only reason she joined a gang was to survive, because she knew she'd be dead on the streets. Long story short, Greg, she winds up doing 6.5 years. She gets out. She's the manager of a pancake house. She's going to county college at night, and she's reunified with her two daughters. And she's like the healthiest, good person, loving person with her children, who are special. And I remember going from Thanksgiving, when her children would come for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and they've got 2 hours, and I'm like, oh my God, this thing is so effed up, because like the girls would be crying. It was just torturous. To now, she's reunified as a family. She has a second chance. And so like, I'm just saying to America, she made a decision to survive. I'm not sure Jim McGreevy would have made a different decision, or Greg Kelly. I'm not sure any of us would have. And so, like, as my grandmother would say, until you walk in that person's shoes or moccasins or whatever it is. And so it's just looking at these people as people, looking at these individuals as individuals. And that, as I went back and would say to my daughter, you know, you are a strong, you know, you are a strong, precious and valuable child of God. And now this young woman believes that about herself, and she's completely reframed and told herself a different story. And most importantly, or as importantly, she's telling her two daughters a different story about their lives, so that they'll break that cycle.
Wow. Jim McGreevy, a true public servant. Amazing. So appreciate what you're doing. If anybody wants to help, is there anything the general public can do, or are you all set?
No. We, like, you know, we have a great ambassador program, and, you know, we're always in need of feminine hygiene products. I can't tell you, this is like nuts. Don't get me started, as I'll get on my rant, that the women, like the women's feminine hygiene products, the women have to pay for them. They have a certain, so it's always when women come out of prison, you know, we try to support them with feminine hygiene products, with, you know, basic necessities. And so it's not only underwear, not only socks, but hygiene products and soaps. And so what we try to do is for the men and women, but for the women particularly, don't get me, I'm just going to go lunacy, but it's just like nuts that we don't provide women feminine hygiene products, what they need behind the wall. And so when these women get out, they don't bring anything with them, and they need it immediately. So we've got a great program called the Ambassadors Program. We do with the AME and the Baptist churches and the Catholic churches. And we've got a great ambassador program that's on our website, www.njreentry.org. So if people want to give, particularly for feminine hygiene products, that's what we need every day.
Governor McGreevy seems like a really happy, well-adjusted man, and he is. I've spent some time with him. He seems like just a highly functioning, good person, and this group that he's heading seems like they're doing very important work. We talked about this a moment ago, njreentry.org, njreentry.org. Before I go, I'd like to remind you, if you want easy and crazy cheap passport renewal, download the It's Easy app from the App Store. It's easy, I-T-S-E-A-S-Y. It's the best way to have your passport ready to go as soon as the world opens up. It's easy, and it is easy. Download the app today. Take the pictures right on your own phone. It is pretty cool. Thank you for listening very, very much. Special thanks to our executive producer, Maya Zumwalt, our editor, Matt, and we'll talk again soon.